history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are untold stories there, stories that should not remain untold, but will unless we take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And you know, it's amazing what happens when we do that. All the things that we gain in the process. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Memorial Day weekend, and it definitely feels a little different this year. In some parts of our country, even the ability to place flags in cemeteries to honor the fallen is limited because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But honor them we will. Today you're going to hear the memories of two World War II veterans, one in the Pacific, one in Europe, and what they were experiencing 75 years ago this week. And if you're thinking, wait a second, I thought the war in Europe was already over 75 years ago this week, you're right, but it wasn't over yet for this particular veteran. If you go all the way back to the War for Independence, well over a million Americans have died while serving our country. And Memorial Day is our opportunity to remember them and their supreme sacrifice. More than 406,000 Americans paid that ultimate price during World War II. One of those was a Marine fighter pilot named Maynard Kelly. He was posthumously awarded the Navy Cross, but it had nothing to do with his exploits in the air. Keep that name in mind as we hear the story of another veteran whose path would intersect with Kelly's exactly 75 years ago this Memorial Day on Okinawa. Dana Mulder, nicknamed Zeke, was in his first year at Loma Linda University in Southern California when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He was living with his aunt near that Seventh-day Adventist school and majoring in theology.
I came home and she said, well, there were a couple men here today. And she said, they were FBI and they're asking about you. And I thought, well, what did I do wrong? Come to find out, the Adventists were asked to be non-combatants. In other words, they feel, thou shalt not kill. And so they, but they had anticipated this. So then in my senior year, they had it was like a school where you go to it and learn to march and how to do first aid and a whole bunch of anything that had to do with, you know, where you could participate in war, but you weren't supposed to work on Sabbath or to kill.
Sure.
And so anyway, I participated in that all that year. See, when I started taking theology, then I guess they were just checking up on everybody. But anyway, that was where that's how I ended up there.
I guess that would get your attention when you come home and find out the FBI was on your tail.
Well, yeah, and she said they'd been following me, so I don't know. But it kind of surprised me. But you want to remember that in the story because it had a consequence. In other words, everything I'm telling you seemed to lean one way or another and affect my life in one way or another. I went and took, you know, a physical. I didn't pass the eye test. Because I wore glasses all my life, and it's just I had poor eyesight. The only thing is, the only salvation was I was so farsighted, so I could see in the distance actually better than I could with a book. And so reading was always kind of difficult to me because I couldn't see too well. There was a lady in Hollywood that said for a certain amount of money she could make it so I could pass the eye test. So I said, okay, let's go for it.
And now, I think you told me $350?
Yeah.
Now, that's a lot of money in the 1940s.
I thought, well, if that's what it takes. But I went to her for about four times, I think. And in other words, she charged me so much each time, but the total thing was $300 and some. Anyway, I went and took the test again, and I passed it. So then I thought, okay, well, I'm in. So I went to the induction center. I joined the Navy then. I went to the induction center. They passed me there. And I for those that went through the induction, it was quite a, it was kind of almost comical sometimes. Some of the questions they'd ask you, they would, do you like girls, and do you do this or you do that, and I don't know whether they'd get in trouble for asking questions like that now or not, but anyway, that's the way it was there. But anyway, they accepted me, and so then I had 10 days, I think it was, and then I went in, I went to San Diego to be inducted. So in San Diego, when I arrived there, they gave us another physical. The guy that he gave me the physical, he said, well, how did you get in here? You can't see. And I said, well, I'm here. Why don't you just let me stay? And he thought for a while and says, okay. So here I am in the Navy.
When you did get in the Navy, they asked you, well, what are you good at? What kind of experience have you had? And what did you tell them?
Well, I told them about when I had taken that first aid training, and, you know, I just shared that with them. And so the doctor said, well, it sounds like you've had enough first aid experience and enough marching experience and all that. And because of my eyesight, he said, well, I'm going to put you in the hospital corps, the Navy Medical Corps. I was a corpsman then in the Navy. I didn't even go to corps school, which was everybody that went into Navy were supposed to do that. So here I went immediately out of boot camp. Why, then I was at the San Diego Hospital, and that was the Naval Hospital there in San Diego. It's just next to Balboa Park.
So were you seeing patients there that were soldiers already back from the war?
I was like an aide, or, you know, I wasn't a doctor. I was just...
Right, sure.
I was just working on the ward. Tarawa had been a big battle in the Pacific, and I was on a ward where you have bone problems. You know, we had the guys that had been in that action on Tarawa. We had them. So that's where I was working.
Was that hard for you to see how these guys had been disfigured and wounded and injured? What did that do to you just as a young man? I mean, you're still a teenager, and having to stare that stuff square in the face every day.
I never did look at it that way. I always just felt like, well, I'm helping these guys, and you felt sorry for them, and yet I was surprised at the attitude that some of those guys that were wounded and had broken bones and this type of thing, the ones that were recuperating, if they were well enough, they would give them some type of small assignments of jobs to do. And we had an elevator that went up and down in the hospital. The guy that ran the elevator had lost a leg.
Mm.
And so he had a wooden leg. And one day I went up the elevator, and he had his leg off, and he was hollowing out a hole inside it where your calf would be. He says, oh, this is where I can hide stuff, you know. And he didn't feel, I was so surprised that he would take the attitude like, well, poor me. He was just like, I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be here. And I'm just having a good time.
And I imagine the more people you see like that, the harder it is to ever feel sorry for yourself.
Well, that's true. That's true. When I first went to Naval Hospital, a friend of mine that I had met in college, he came to me and he said, hey, they're sending a bunch of cycle patients back to Fort Worth, Texas, and it's going to take a couple weeks. Why don't you sign up for it? I said, well, that sounds like a good deal. So I signed up for it. But then when I got back to San Diego from that trip on the train, then they put me on night duty. And the night duty was one full month every night of the week, every day it was. It was just you were continuous on that time. Well, my problem was that my folks lived in San Diego then in El Cajon. I'd work nights, and in the daytime you don't sleep all day long, so I'd get up and go home and visit my folks, or sometimes I'd even go as far away as L.A. and visit some friends up there, and then I'd be back. Well, about towards the end of that month of night duty, one night the nurse came to me and she said, you're just worn out. And she led me back to the solarium and to the bed back there and put me in the sack. And she says, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Anyway, then when I got off of night duty, they were having spinal meningitis. There was a case in that. In fact, one person had died, and there were two more that were sick. So here they put me on that ward, and I thought, good night. I can remember walking down the street there at the hospital, and I thought, here I get in here. I've got things going my way, and there they put me on a ward, and I'm going to get spinal meningitis and die right here. And so I went to a yeoman who took care of the personnel, and I told her, I said, I don't want to be there. I want to get out of there. And she says, well, I'll see what I can do. Well, the next day, I went back to see her again, and she looked kind of surprised, and she said, well, I haven't had time to do anything. And I said, well, I want you to do something. She said, you don't tell me what to do. She says, I'm going to fix you. And I said, I won't give you a chance. I said, I want sea duty. And she says, I don't have any sea duty. So I said, well, give me the Fleet Marines. Now, that was, if I'd have known what the Fleet Marines were like, and the casualty figures of what those guys went through, why I wouldn't have been so eager. But anyway, that was on a Tuesday. And Thursday morning, before about 6 o'clock, they got us up out of the sack. We went out and stood in front of the barracks, and they had what they called short arms inspection. After we passed that, then they sent us to, they called it Field Med School.
Right.
Where the Navy guys made the transfer into the Marine Corps. And that was an 8-week course, so that's how I ended up at the Marine Corps.
And how long would it be from there till you ended up shipping overseas?
Well, then it was over a year, about maybe a year and 2 or 3 months. Of course, I went through the Field Med School, and then I was assigned to an aviation outfit at Miramar. That in itself was a blessing right there. The good Lord looks after fools and little children, and sometimes I did things foolishly. But anyway, that year that I spent at El Toro, it was a good learning experience because, you know, we were busy. We had a lot of stuff going on, and that time passed very rapidly.
And after that time, you finally were sent overseas. You were assigned to a squadron of Marine pilots?
Yes. We were F-4Us, and at that time, the F-4U was about the most deadly plane in the Pacific. Now, the Zeros were more maneuverable, but the pilots of the F-4Us finally got on how to handle them, and so our squadron, that was 39 kills, and that was only in the period of about, not more than 2 months, 3 months. We were assigned to the north end of Okinawa, and the F-4Us were doing like picket duty, and they were up further north kind of trying to protect the picket ships. And those are the people that took quite a bit of casualties. The Japanese would get in there real quick. But anyway, that's how many planes we got. But that was a year and a half, about not quite a year and a half after when I got to Okinawa.
And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back. Something happened on Okinawa on the night of May 24th on into the early morning hours of May 25th, 1945, that did not happen at any other point in that 83-day battle that claimed over 14,000 American lives. The Japanese called it a Giretsu attack. Find out what that means when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.